If anyone could start the evening with a question or the idea of a topic that we should talk about, I would prefer that to just launching out, but does anyone have a thought about something we could talk about here? Something you might like to know about Swamiji, about Ananda, about the path, anything at all?
Very often one keeps reading this called self-realized souls when we say. I would like to expand on that.
Just what does it mean?
I understand, but I would like to understand it from your perspective. What's a self, when we say self-realized soul.
Okay. Bear in mind my perspective is not that of a self-realized soul, but I'm happy to give it to you. I was walking up the stairs in my own apartment one day, and I was conscious of the burden of my own ego. Just, I'm a relatively happy person, energetic and so on like that, but there's always a certain amount of restless edges and anxiety about a little about this. Will I get the project done? Will we solve this problem? And as I was, it was just odd because sometimes these things come like this. I was just going up the stairs. There was nothing particular about the moment. And I thought about what it would be to have no vrittis, have nothing in the chakras except complete calmness. Patanjali's definition of union, just nothing. And to be utterly fearless is how it also came to me, that there would be nothing in the whole universe that could disturb my peace at all, because standing in the center of oneness, there's no vibration to disturb. And just for much faster than it takes to say it, it was like for just a second I felt that freedom. And I just could imagine, you know, how a person could incarnate and move through this world if they were nowhere in this world but always in the center of the spirit. So what self-realization is about is to have transcended any oscillation. You know, our consciousness is oscillating all the time, if you want to think about it. Isn't that so? I don't even just mean being disturbed in meditation. I mean, we're always shifting from one thought to the next, and we're often shifting from one small point of tension to the next. So having all of that removed, I mean, this is a small way of saying it, but I'm trying to come up to it from the bottom to see, sort of to see what it would be like. Let's see, there was another thought that I wanted to have. Oh, there's another aspect about a self-realized soul, and because you can read definitions in many places, I'm just giving you the piece of it that has struck me. Because the definition of a self-realized master is that he is one who has attained self-realization. Before master incarnated, he was an avatar because he had attained that realization quite some time in previous incarnations. But he said he remembered all the way back to being a diamond. That was his actual statement. He could remember the individual consciousness that became Paramhansa Yogananda, he could remember it all the way back to being a gemstone. Now, I asked Swamiji once the question, because someone asked me, you know, how long does it take to finish being a diamond? I asked the question afterwards, what do you become after you become a diamond? Do you become an emerald? Do you become a redwood tree? What happens next? And because I've sometimes sat at the breakfast table with Swami Kriyananda and can take advantage of that and ask him a question, I told my friend I would ask. So I don't know if you were there, Narayani. We were sitting at the breakfast table in Los Angeles, and I said to Swamiji, I asked him, I said, someone asked me, how long does it take to get out from being a diamond? Swami looked at me and he said, that is a really stupid question, is what he said. And I was honest enough to say, I thought it was fascinating, Swamiji, that's why I asked you. And then he sort of refused to answer me. I mean, not, he wasn't really upset, but he just refused to answer. But as often happens when he sort of rejects something, then something else comes through. And then he just turned and he said, compared to eternity, all time is short. So even from our point of view, it takes a long time to get to be from being a diamond, but compared to eternity, it was no time at all. This, you know, Swami just had a way of always turning the perspective. But the point being, if Yogananda remembered being a diamond, that means he went through every single possible stage of gradually awakening consciousness until he was completely free. Now, what that also means, practically speaking, is whatever any of us are going through and the form of our life experience, an Indian housewife, an American woman, whatever you happen to be, the form is not the definition of it. The definition is the vibration of consciousness that you have between absolute delusion and perfect freedom. You can express that vibration by attachment to your house, attachment to your children, attachment to your money, but what's really involved is the degree of separation from the infinite and the degree of advancement from complete ego. Whatever vibration any of us experience, Master has been there. It's one thing to think that he's compassionate, that he understands, that he'll help you, but it's quite another to realize that he's been through it. And therefore, the complete acceptance on the part of the Master of our reality. There's because it's simply the necessary step between being a diamond and being a self-realized Master. And there's nothing to worry about. There's nothing to be ashamed of. And above all, there's no reason to think that Master won't come right into that vibration and help you through it. Because the whole art of being a disciple, really, is to not be afraid to be who you are right in the light of the Master. Swamiji tells the story in The Path about he came to Mount Washington in his first meeting with Master. He was initiated as a disciple. He moved right into the ashram. We all read that story and you can't help but think, oh, if only I could have been there. And then, oddly enough, Swami talks about the fact that very few people came, and of the people who came to live with Master, very few of them stayed. It's sort of hard for us to think of from this perspective. But Swamiji explains in there that the reason most of them left was because Master's light was total. It illuminated everything in its aura, and most people were dismayed about what it revealed about them. Because in the presence of a Master, you see, your awareness increases. And when you climb up to a mountain, you can also look down into the canyon that you didn't know was there. So everything about you becomes illumined. And Swamiji said most people couldn't stand in that light, and they removed themselves from the light. Of course, they took everything with them, but by removing themselves from the light, they had the illusion that it wasn't happening anymore. So we don't have the physical choice of being physically in the presence, but we have the inner choice. And in the Bible it says the degree to which you receive is the degree to which you can be transformed. So I personally have found it extremely helpful when I'm just caught in something that seems so, I guess, embarrassing is the word I want to use. You know, just not my idea of who I'd like to be, but well, there we are, just like that. Then I really remember Master was here. He got out of it. And he knows that I can get out of it. So let's just work on it. Let's just go forward. I think that would be it. Now, with Swamiji, Swamiji was not self-realized, he said, before he was born. He was not an avatar. His consciousness was, he was a free soul, is how I think about him. He was just a free soul. He was not burdened. And what he demanded of us, what happened when you were with him, is that his vibration, you were forced to lift your vibration to be with him. And the blessing of his company over time, I realized, was not that he was giving energy into us so much, is that when we were with him, we wanted to be where he was. You know, he inspired love in your heart, and you sort of go toward him. That's the power of devotion. But in order to go toward him, you had to meet him where he was. Otherwise, he wasn't there. I mean, there was no other place to meet him. And that's why many people were never magnetized, because they didn't want to go where he was.
But Swamiji is not in the line of masters. What's the reason for that?
Well, because...
Or is there a difference? I just want to understand that.
Well, Master himself, Yogananda, always said that he was the last in the line of gurus. Now, Swamiji has made it clear, though, that he can't possibly be the last self-realized person on this spiritual path, or else this spiritual path doesn't work. Right? And Swamiji also said that others on this path would have their own disciples, because it's part of the divine law that in order to become liberated yourself, you have to help others become free. The number that Swami always says is you have to help 6 others. Sometimes we joke among ourselves when somebody comes who seems particularly difficult, we try to decide who he belongs to. Is he one of your 6, you know? Because I'm not talking just about my batchmates, I'm talking about all of us, you know, the people who come into our lives that we're helping. This is how it all works. But even in that context, Swamiji was always emphasizing that inasmuch as this is a line of avatars, that even if that energy goes through a particular expression, as many of us feel it goes through Swamiji, it goes through him to Master, to this line of gurus, and up to the divine. I think of it when Swamiji was living, I thought sometimes, Master was the king of the whole country. But our particular city of Ananda was governed by Swamiji. And it would not please the king to ignore the one he put in charge. And after that, I just left it to them. I figured I know, I can feel Swami's magnetism pulling me into the light. And if he wants, if at a certain point, you know, he hands me over to Master or whatever happens, I figure by the time it happens, it won't be an issue for me. But we naturally relate to what we know. That's just the way life is. Swamiji was closer to us and more with us than Master could be. But through him, I had autobiography of a yogi. I was studying the teachings of Vivekananda, which were they suited me. They were very intellectual, more intellectual. I had autobiography of a yogi, and on page 9, Lahiri, or maybe it's page 13, Lahiri materializes in a wheat field, and I couldn't go there. I couldn't have somebody materializing in a wheat field on page 9 of this book. just, I didn't know what to do with it, so I just closed it and put it away. And then a couple of years later, I met Swami Kriyananda, found that he was a disciple of Yogananda, was totally just captured by his consciousness. Because he was a disciple of Master, I went and opened Autobiography of Yogi. All of a sudden, it made perfect sense to me. It was so dramatic. It didn't make any sense to me until I met Master's disciple. And then I thought, why didn't I see this the first time? But there had to be that bridge for me. And that sort of has always been my understanding since then. But Swamiji would never, and he was very definite with us, don't make me the sixth guru. You know, because he said that's not what Master wanted. The line is complete, but the spirit and the revelation goes on and on. Any other questions or thoughts?
We're on the spot. All of us just want to be nice.
We want to be nice.
Being nice is something that comes to me naturally. But there are times when, you know, as individuals, it's very possible that you get a negative thought.
Yes. Just one. Rarely. But occasionally, yes.
Yeah. So, I'm just trying to wonder, what's the best way to deal with it, you know? So what I normally do is I just say, Hari Om, and uh-huh. I, you know, just get rid of that negative thought. But my question is that, do you reach a point where negative thoughts cease to come, or is there a good way to kind of deal with negative thoughts, and is there a way to kind of just somehow prevent them from just rising in your mind in the first place?
I'm in an odd place in my own spiritual life, and I'm going to say this first, and then I'll go to your question. I can't remember clearly how change took place. I was asked on a radio interview I did yesterday morning for the Finding Happiness movie that we have, a radio interview in America. It would be 6:30 in the morning here, so I got on the internet, on the Skype thing, and we talked. This woman says, because Finding Happiness is about Ananda and its history, what's the hardest thing, the most difficult thing you had to do being part of Ananda? She mentions the fire in 1976 when so much of the community burned down. It's described in the movie and it's very dramatic. I have to add, I didn't lose my house. I was living as a nun. I didn't have a house. I had almost nothing. The only thing I owned that was important to me was my harmonium and my mala, but I didn't lose either of those. But she raised the fire as the hardest thing you had to do. I said, the fire was fun. And I remember it as just being totally fun. I even remember when it was happening that it was fun. Nobody was hurt. We were physically safe. So, of course, that made it easier. But it was exhilarating to be challenged, to rise to such a dramatic occasion. When the fire was actually, we had 900 acres there, and the fire came up this hill. The details are unimportant, but it came up this hill and was coming down, and our publications building was in the path of the fire. And I was probably in charge of publications or had some role in it then. This was all before computers, so everything was much more physical. And our mailing list was on these metal plates. And the fire was coming toward that building. We wanted to get as much out of it as we could. And so I and this woman named Seva it was this long, steep hill. We were running up that hill to get as much out of that building as we could. Trucks were coming up, and we were throwing things into trucks. I'm running up the hill. Immediately I say, we're going to have to rebuild no matter what happens. The first thing we have to take is the mailing list. I mean, it's just like immediately, in the midst of the challenge, we were already thinking of the solution. And we pulled out original recordings, negatives of the books, you know, just everything that we could. It didn't burn as it happened. But the fact that when she asked me that, I tried to think, what was hard? And I really can't think of anything that was hard, because anything that was hard, it just resolved eventually. And so the first answer to your question is, just keep trying and don't give up. And at some point, if you don't give up, I don't think you ever actually, like, master anything. I think at a certain point, God feels sorry for you and says, oh, you've tried so hard, and then he just sucks it up and takes it away. Because I can't remember a point where I actually conquered anything. I just remember not quitting. I remember falling into the pit a lot. And then, you know, there you are, whether it's one thought or a month of them or a year of them. I remember it got to be between Swamiji and me. There was this cycle where I got really out of tune, and he finally said, how are you? And he said, I said, I don't know, sir. How am I? And then he said he was a little worried about me. I said, I'm worried about myself. And we sort of worked it out from there. But ever thereafter, it got to be a joke. He would say, how are you? I don't know, sir. How am I? You know, it's like, how do I know how I am? I'm just doing the best that I can do, and I'm not going to quit. And I think if you just persevere and don't, after devotion, I think the ability to have a sense of humor, as I think the second most important thing for success on the spiritual path, I don't think that's in any of the scriptures. That's, you know, wisdom from the trenches. Because one of the ways that you don't quit is you just don't take it all that seriously. You know? Okay, so I'm having a negative thought. So I'm having, like, a whole lot of negative thoughts. So I'm really upset about everything. It's like, just don't take it so seriously. It's just a stage on the path. And if you just keep your eye on the goal, even if you're just wandering through the mud, you're going over there. It doesn't really matter how much of a mess it is here, because this is the transit lounge. This isn't your goal. You're just walking through this. That's where you're going. So the obvious answer to negative thoughts is have a positive one and train yourself. Swamiji's advice to me, which I repeat endlessly because it was so important, is I asked him a very complicated question about a very difficult dilemma that I often faced. And how would I know what to do if this happens and that happens? How would I know what to do? And he answered me. He said, you're asking, how do you know what God wants from you? And he said, you won't be able to tell in a moment of crisis unless you have practiced when it was easier. So instead of waiting until you have a big negative thought to try to have a big positive thought, every time you have a little negative thought, have a big positive thought. In other words, practice when it's not so hard. Because every big problem you have, if you really look at it, is also a little problem. And it's often difficult to solve the big problem, but it's not so hard to solve the little one. And if you practice all the time, then when the big one hits, you already, you know, you already have a little bit under you. And the most important thing is that delusion is finite, which means it won't last forever. Realization is eternal. And compared to eternity, all time is quick. And even just from the perspective of a few decades on the spiritual path, which is not much compared to eternity, my advice to everyone is just don't quit. And just burn that into your soul. Just don't quit. Don't worry about how well or badly you're doing. Just don't quit. And God will take mercy on you. I heard Swamiji in something, some little television, it was asked me about truth. Someone said, what is your greatest accomplishment? And first he kind of, actually, what he said first was, I'm still here. And he didn't mean he was still in the body. He meant, I'm still a disciple. And really, that's a really big accomplishment. Get to the end of the race. Don't worry if you're standing up or bloody or bruised. Just crawl across the finish line. Just don't give up. Okay. Other thoughts? Comments? Do you have a question? No. That can't be the end of the conversation. That's what they did to me this afternoon. You can't do this to me today, too.
In fact, in Gita, Arjuna asked this question to Krishna. That if you are on the path of spirituality and if you give up, what happens to that soul? Will it perish?
Yeah.
So he says, no, you will not perish. Even if he fails, he has a negative orientation for a while, and he shift from the path a little bit, still he will be taken care of in the next birth. That's what he is assured.
You know, Master puts it in a practical way, too. He says, once you've tasted the freedom that spirit gives you, you really can't be satisfied with anything else. You know, it's like your soul knows what real freedom and real happiness feels like. And so even if you get distracted and some piece of karma takes you off on some little story, your own recollection of the happiness that you knew in a spiritual way just makes it impossible. We've been running the same temple in Palo Alto, south of San Francisco. That's where I live. We've been running that temple now since 1987, quite a few years. And it's been very interesting to me to watch people leave and return. People will, because we also have a community, but we run a teaching center and a temple, and we have regular activities. So many hundreds of people attend the temple at different times, even though only a very small handful actually live in the community. But it becomes very much the center of their spiritual life. And so people will be very active now. You know, they'll be active for 6 or 7 or 10 years, and then a little bit of karma will take them away. Or else I knew them even from the early years of Ananda Village, where they would live there or were part of it, and then some karma comes and takes them away. But I've seen so often now, because I've been there long enough, 10 years, 12 years will pass and the same person will suddenly be standing there again. Where were you? And it's so touching to me to hear them say, you know, I went and I did this business, I did this marriage, I had these children, I did these things, but I could never forget the experience here. And one man said to me so touchingly, he said, I've been so unhappy for so many years now. I tried to remember the last time I was happy. And he said, I remember the last time I was happy was when I was part of Ananda, when I was in touch with these teachings. He said, so I've come back because that's what I need. Now, that's fortunate. That's one incarnation. But that's what happens to us. We just get sucked away. You know, I think about sometimes how, let me put it this way. I remember watching at Ananda Village once because, you know, when you're in the spiritual center for a long time, you get to see how karma affects people. And I noticed that once you move away from the spiritual vibration, it's very subtle. And if you start listening too strongly to other realities, oh, I really need to take care of myself. I don't really have time to go. Oh, there's a lot of traffic tonight. I think I won't go. You know, I don't really need to meditate this morning. I don't really have time to meditate. I don't meditate well anyway. But you move a little bit off from the vibration. And this vibration is so subtle that once you lose it, you can't really even remember it. You know, it sort of fades from your memory. That's the power of delusion. And that's one of the reasons why Master emphasized community, and that's why he emphasized satsang so much. It isn't even so much that every time you come into satsang, you learn something new or something like that, but you just come back into that vibration. And then it's easier for you to remember what that vibration sounds like. I'm not a particularly good singer, and I can really lose the right notes or the right melody, and especially if I'm trying to sing a harmony part. The melodies I can remember, but the harmony parts I lose. And I'll think that I'm doing it right. I'll think that I have all the notes just right. And it sounds okay to me. But then I'll move back in to someone who has it exactly right, and I'll realize that without even realizing it, I was beginning to shift off of where it really is. And for all of us, there's really, it's not that easy to stay in tune. And I don't want to exaggerate how difficult it is either, but we really have to respect that it's not that easy to stay in tune. Especially, look where we're living. And there's all these people out here, and they're all attuning to another vibration. It's not necessarily, I mean, it would be easy to criticize it, but that's not even the point. It's they're singing a different melody. And if you're trying to keep this this very subtle, specific melody going in your own consciousness, vibration is the right word, you need to continually put yourself back where it's sounding really well. We are so gifted because it's Dwapara Yuga. It's an expanding age, and technology is dissolving space and time. Swamiji is off the planet. We can't really sit in the room with him physically now. But you can go into Ananda India, which I've been doing regularly. You scroll down, there's a little picture of Swami, and there's just all these lists of his recordings. And so most of the time when I energize, I click on one of the 12-minute programs, and he's just talking to me again. And I love to hear what he has to say. I find his conversation delightful, and his humor is marvelous. But even if I'm not like tuning into it on that level, he's got the tone. And I just spend a little time in his vibration, and it just helps me remember what the right melody is. And so it's a very important part. I mean, there's a small group of us in this room. You're not alone. And for us to all appreciate what this means, to have other devotees, and even if we're by ourselves, of course, we can silently meditate and we must, but we can bring this vibration in so many different ways, and that will save us. Because if we don't keep renewing it, when I used to teach the meditation, the level one, what you call level one classes in our temple, for many years I taught them all. Everybody would get very enthusiastic about meditation. And in the last class of the series, I would often talk to them about the fact that a lot of people stop meditating. And you're so enthusiastic about it now. What could cause you to stop meditating? You think, why would I ever stop meditating? And I said, several reasons will cause you to. First, I'll say one first. Because it begins to work. Which sounds paradoxical, doesn't it? But what I was saying about being in the light of Master's energy, your awareness begins to expand, and as your awareness expands, you become aware of many things. You may become aware of qualities in your own nature that you really wished you didn't have. You may become aware of problems that you're going to have to solve. You may begin to see circumstances in your life in a different way, and the implications of that are scary. So in one way or another, it begins to work, and we follow the same path that those disciples followed who left Master. Oh, this is just too much light. I'll just back up from the light. Doesn't change your state of consciousness at all, but it postpones it. But the other reason that people stop is they don't keep renewing the energy. And you just have to keep renewing the energy. And as I was saying, there's many ways that you can do it. The best is in person. But you also can pull all of these things now, recordings and videos and so on. But if your enthusiasm begins to wane, ask yourself, what am I doing to renew my energy? And invariably, you will find that you're not. You know, we all go through it at whatever level we go through it. Gee, I'm feeling a little dry. I mean, a few days ago, I was just sort of thinking that. I wasn't feeling that inspired, and here I am responsible for a lot of things. Oh, well, I haven't been listening to Swamiji as much as I should, as I want to. I just got busy and was doing a bunch of other stuff, and I just turned on my computer. And as soon as he's talking to me in my room, all of a sudden my energy is there again. So, the solutions are often so simple. We actually imagine they're much harder than they are because it's hard for us to believe. Because once you have lost the vibration, it seems so mysterious to you, you don't know where it is. But then once you're back into it, it's very simple. Swamiji said once, it was a satsang at his house in Gurgaon, and he made this comment that because the manifested world is so complicated, and because we think of God being responsible for all this enormous complication, we imagine that the divine is very complicated. And we let our mind get all kind of tangled up. And, you know, do I have free will? Do I not have free will? We get all tangled up in these questions. He said, the fact is, you see, the complexity is created by the vibration of Om, by the oscillating vibration. But the closer you come to the center, you see the simpler and simpler and simpler it gets. Until when you actually get into the heart of it, it has the absolute simplicity of one. You know, one is not complicated because there's no alternative, there's no oscillation. And the closer you get to that, you know, the opposites are smaller and smaller. And this is why saints become so childlike. You know, a child's life is so simple. It's all just enthusiasm and the joy of doing and this open-hearted expectation that everybody in the world loves me, of course, and I am the center of everybody's universe. You know how children are? There was a little girl in our community. When she was born until she was about 3, she always looked like an imperious old woman. She did not have a baby face. She just didn't have it. She just was holding this look on her face. And the look sort of said, where are all the servants? This is not their day off. You know, sort of energy like this. And she just couldn't seem to remember that she was a child. She was just like this all the time. I said to her parents, I said, when she was about 4, I said, you know, she looked like an imperious old woman looking for her servants all the time. I said, she doesn't look like that as much now. And they started laughing, and they said, because she found her servants, her mother and me. About children. You know, children are just, they're so demanding with that just complete expectation that, of course, you're going to take them in. I mean, why would you not? There's a story. Oh, I love this story. We used to go to 4 Garpar Road, where Master had his home. I say we used to. When I first came to India, my first trips to India were as part of pilgrimages that we would bring of Master's devotees from America who had never been to India. My husband and I and another couple, Durga and Vidura, some of you know them, the 4 of us, over a period of like 20 years, every year or every other year, we would bring 30 or so Americans and we would take them to the places sacred to Master. Varanasi, we used to go to Kashmir to the Shankaracharya temple until we couldn't go there. We'd go to Puri, and then we'd go to Calcutta, go to Master's house there. And over the course of time, we got to know the family. Hare Krishna, Master's nephew, was still living when we first started going. More members of that generation, his wife and his sister, were all still living. They're all passed now. And Master came to India in 1935, and he only stayed for that 1 year. Otherwise, his life was in America. Hare Krishna was 15 when Master came, and he remembers. He has almost adult memories of being with him and being with Master. He sat next to his father, Sananda Ghosh. He was on one side and Master was on the other when Master guided his father to draw the picture of Babaji. So he would tell us all these stories of these wonderful things that would happen. Sri Yukteswar used to come visit what was Hare Krishna's grandfather in that house. So these are wonderful stories. There's films of Hare Krishna telling these stories. Well, 1 year, his sister Shefley came also to visit. Shefley didn't speak English, so the story had to be translated for us. Shefley was only 3 when Master came. So she doesn't remember his visit at all. But everybody in the family, I'll wait till that goes. But all the adult members of the family remember her and Master, and they told her over and over the story. And this is how it happened for her. She was a 3-year-old child. The first time Master came into the house, she just thought he was the most wonderful being she had ever seen. She also made the decision that he belonged to her. And she belonged to him, and no part of her intruded in that thought. Just like a child, she wanted to be close to him. Of course he wanted to be close to her. Why would he not? And so whenever he would come in the house, she would just find him. She would, you know, hold onto his leg. She would climb onto his lap. And Master responded to her, just like that. And then one of the stories that they love to tell is when they were going to a movie, and I guess the rules say you can't bring a child that small in, so they tried to peel Shefley off of Master and leave her at home, and she would have absolutely none of it. She was just having a total fit that he was leaving and she wasn't going with him. So he decided, he picked her up, he held her against his chest, he buttoned his coat over her, and he smuggled her into the movie theater. And so while everyone else is watching the movie, she has her head right against his heart and just sat there the whole time. Just picture that. So I went through this very interesting cycle listening to this. And my first thought was, oh, she met Master once and she was so small, she doesn't even remember. And it just seemed like, how unfortunate. But then I sort of backed up just a tiny step and I thought, what an incredible blessing, because of course the fact that her mind doesn't remember doesn't mean that her soul doesn't remember. Her soul remembers perfectly. That she chose to be with Master at a time when absolutely nothing would inhibit her. Suffer little children to come unto me. And often in my mind, and this is where we started with that question, when I feel a little dry or a little unworthy, a little distant, I pretend that I'm Shefley. And Master has come into the house, and there is no question about where I belong or how he's going to respond to me. And I just lie down on his chest and let him button his coat over me. You know? Because God is really simple. It's we who make it very complicated, because all that complication actually serves us, because it gives us something else to do. except what we really need to do, which is just open our hearts and surrender to it. So, when Shefley was telling us that story, we were just, I remember sitting in the house and just, we'd been visiting for years before they told us that. And, you know, just this arc opens in front of us of this guru-disciple relationship, you know, and you might almost say in its purest form. There's two more little points on this. There's a story about Anandamayi Ma, about a fly that was on her face and people kept trying to shoo it away and it just wouldn't leave. And Ma said, "This is a saint from the past who wanted to be close to this body." He said, "Let him be." This world, who can figure it out? And then I was reading a chronicle of Anandamayi Ma's life from very early. And, of course, at the beginning, people didn't really quite know who she was because she manifested in an unusual manner and there was no context for who she was. And it dawned on people slowly what they had in her. And at a certain point, she was still a young woman. People began to call her mother or call her Ma. And she was relating in a very easy way, so they sort of asked her if it was okay if they called her Ma. And her answer was exquisite. She said, well, if you want to, because she never took a position about anything. She didn't have a self to take a position. But she said, you know, mother is a wonderful relationship, but you always respect your mother, so there's still a little bit of distance. She said, "You should make a place for me in your heart where you have put your own child." She said, "That's how you should look at me." This is what the saints tell us, you know, all of this. Oh, I'm worried about how restless I am in meditation. Oh, I'm so concerned about this. I'm so worried about that. If you have a place in your heart where you keep your own baby, you know, you just love your baby. You don't stop and think about it. You cannot help yourself. That's what Ma was trying to say to us. You know, you have to love me in such a way that it never crosses your mind that anything could come between us. And this is how the saints and masters are trying to exemplify it for us. So.
There's just one question I have.
Certainly.
A person who's suffering from ill health,
mm-hmm.
You said do not quit.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say anything more
for
that? About that?
Is it like chronic ill health or terminal ill health? Chronic ill health.
Could we pass healing today for that person too?
Say what last part you said?
Could we pass healing for that person too today?
You're asking that we can pray for someone specifically. The question was.
Take it up on your voice. I can't hear the question.
I said, she said, do not quit was the advice she gave. Just have your eyes on the goal.
Mm-hmm.
So for a person who is suffering from ill health, could she say something more for the person?
About how you cope. If there's,
you
know, you have to go back to the fact that there is no objective standard that everybody has to meet that is external. You know, if a person is given ill health, it's simply the necessary stage that they have to pass through. And it's inevitable that if the body is impaired, then certain things that others do easily, the person with the impaired body simply can't do. I was talking just a few days ago to some of the devotees, some of the acharyas, and we were talking about, even though, for example, Kriya Yoga is how we have tried to present Master's work here. Swami Kriyananda, when we first arrived in this country, He said, you know, let's lead with Kriya. That was how he put it. Let's see what happens if we do that, which has been very effective. But even Kriya, let me go back a little bit. Swamiji told us that when Master was in public, he talked about many, many things about the spiritual path. But when he was in private, with the disciples especially, he talked about attunement. He talked about aligning the vibration of your consciousness with his. Because, as I was saying, there's something that happens. If you've aligned your vibration with Master, he can just take the rest of it and clean it out. If you receive him. And so even Kriya, as vital as that is, even meditation, as vital as that is a means to attunement. And we might as well do everything we can to become in tune and take advantage of every opportunity. But if certain opportunities are denied us, not because the spirit isn't willing, but for some reason the body that we have is not going to make it possible, we can still go right to the point. And the point is attunement. And a lot of what I've been saying tonight about making a place in your heart and not allowing any thought, any condition to persuade you that you can't love God and be close to God and that Guru isn't going to be close to you. Even the thought that I never meditate and I can't energize and I don't have the energy to chant, whatever it might be, it doesn't make any difference. You know, God is as close to us as our own breath. He is our own breath. And so we have to find this balance point between accepting reality as it is and accepting it peacefully as a gift from God, and then always saying, okay, given this, what can I do to expand? And so I think someone with ill health, which is not my life experience, but I've seen lots of people, and I've seen some constantly rebel against it. And they're not actually healing or transcending, they're just always fighting it. And I've seen others say, okay, this is who I am. And given who I am, how can I still be in tune? And then drawing upon whatever is available to do that, to make it happen. And then, of course, we're not the body. We're just the light, and the light is the only thing that matters. But when your body is pulling you down, it's hard to remember that. That would be the best that I could offer. It's not...
You are saying acceptance instead of saying that you are God's child in your will?
Yeah, that's a very dicey question.
I'm really confused on this.
I know, everybody's confused on this. That's why I'm going to try to see if I can find an answer. Swamiji says there's a difference between having a positive, affirmative attitude and actually, he said, you can't just affirm a reality, affirm away a reality that you haven't yet been willing to face. He said, first you have to face conditions as they are, completely and honestly, and then you have to decide what to do about them. And I'm answering you a little delicately because I've actually sort of wrestled with this one a little bit, because I see people who have chronic conditions, and in the name of affirmation, I can see that they never really want to just say, wow, look at this. Look at what I've got. And I heard Swami just talking about this. If you're just affirming without first having the courage to say, well, this is the challenge that I have, now what will I do about it? And I think there has to be a point of merely to face something is not the same as accepting it as your reality, defining it forever. But I feel it gives you a solid basis on which to then work beyond it. I'm not sure that we've communicated, have we? Yeah. Shivani, can you help me on this?
I think you've
done good. Okay. It's a tough one, because I've watched lots of people who are ill pretend they're not ill. There was a woman who died, and she pretended she wasn't dying. And I don't think that helped her, because she died. But she was never able to just acknowledge that she was dying, because she kept having to affirm that she wasn't. But she was. And so we were always a little out of sync, even being able to help her, because we were never able to deal with what was actually happening. When a friend of mine was dying of cancer, she asked Swami, actually, this question, a similar question, you know, what should I do? I don't want to sit here and think of myself as dying of cancer. He answered, think of yourself as light. And when she was dying, she sort of said to me, I helped her through that, through her death. What should I do? I said, just think about the light. And as soon as she got there, she wasn't saying that she didn't have cancer. She knew she had cancer. She was dying of cancer. But she didn't define herself as having cancer. She just observed that she had it. But then she defined herself as the light. And when she defined herself as the light, that allowed the possibility that the light was going to cure her body. Because it was always there that it could. It didn't. But it didn't matter, because she was defining herself by the light, so whether the body stayed or didn't was not her self-definition.
So basically you leave it to God to you define yourself as light. And
that's the most effective one that I know of. Yeah. You see, a lot of times our affirmation is actually based on fear of facing what's actually happening. And that's a subtle thing, that's a very subtle point. You have to face fear before you can transcend it. You can't hope to transcend it without ever having to face it. So sometimes people who are ill or dying are very afraid, and they're actually motivated by fear to continually affirm here, but what's really gripping them over here is fear. And that fear has to be faced. Oh yeah, I have this illness, I may die. I may be uncomfortable for the rest of my life. If that happens, I accept that. And then we try to become better, instead of just hoping we can affirm it and never have to face it. That's where, you see where the weakness comes in that?
The Bible states, ask and thou shalt receive.
Say again?
The Bible states, ask and thou shalt receive. So can you not say that in faith?
You know, this is a very difficult question. I've faced this with many people, and I have my own understanding of how to deal with it, and then I'm often faced with people who insist on another understanding. And at a certain point, I just have to back up and say, okay, that they feel that if they give up the thought of a miracle healing, that means they don't have faith in God. And I feel, just see what's happening. Accept whatever might happen. And then that to me is not contradictory to having faith in God, but I know people feel that it is. And I'm just being frank with you. I've meditated on this one a lot, and I haven't found a bridge over that. Yeah, if anybody else in the room can help me, that would be great. But
many times this thing comes to my mind. But right. When I think that, okay, if I die, I'll meet my guru.
Yeah.
That time it becomes very
cool. Right.
It becomes very accepting. Many times it means when we think.
We're not afraid of dying. If it's someone that you love who's ill and you want them to get better and you want to have faith that God could or would cure them, just as you're saying, the Bible says, I just usually, when someone wants that point of view, I just support them in it. Because I just support them in that point of view. Because if that's how they see it, even if I might act differently in it, I let them have it. And I can't really say one way or another. It's a very subtle point. Yeah. When my friend was dying of cancer, that very woman, She was so ill, and it was so clear that she had terminal cancer. She actually lived longer than anyone expected. But the day that the doctors told her, really, there's nothing more we can do, you know, your life is almost over, just by pure intuition, I dropped in on her house an hour after the doctor said that to her. She was weeping and weeping. And she said to me, she was a very dear person, she said, "I know this sounds silly to everyone else, but I thought I was going to get better." Just like that, just like a little child. "Maybe you all knew I wasn't going to, but I thought I was." Just like that. And so finally, she really just had to see she was not going to get better. And then she had to really deal with the fact that she wasn't. And that was the first time she had to deal with it. But at that point, she just embraced it completely. And she cried for a while. And she said, how am I going to do this? She has a beautiful home, family, everything. She said, how can I leave all of this? I just held her hand and I was crying with her. I said, it's a wall of tears. There's going to be a lot of tears. And I said, actually, it's a wall of fire. I said, but when you get to the other side of it, you'll find out there's nothing but light. And so she went through that. And then when I came back at the end, she just looked up at me and she said, just like this, "You were right." Just like that, "You were right. On the other side of it, it's nothing but light." And she just then just let everything go, you know, beautifully.
Can I just say one more thing? Mm-hmm. There's this pastor, Joel Austin of Lakewood Church.
Mm-hmm.
His mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and she had 15 days to live, but she's a cancer survivor, and she has been kind of quoting passages from the Bible and with a lot of faith. And she's got wrong, so that is what kind of had me believe in God.
Well, see, this.
This
is why it's a difficult issue, because a person has to be guided from inside. And I've never had a cancer diagnosis. I don't know what it feels like, but I think it's a very narrow path to walk through, and you have to just feel where you're supposed to be in it all the way through. Happy Winningham, a woman in our community, got AIDS. She got AIDS very, very early in the cycle of AIDS, you know, like 20 years ago. And she worked very hard to live, but it was very difficult. She was, like I said, she had the bad flu all the time. And she asked Swami the question. She'd been to the other side and back, and she had no fear of death. She said to Swamiji, "How long do I keep trying to live? When can I just quit?" And he said, "As long as you feel you are making spiritual progress, you should keep your body." He said, "Because if you give it up, you'll just have to reincarnate and be a child again and get to your spiritual family and learn Kriya. And you've done all that. So as long as you feel that you can keep making spiritual progress in the body you have, you should try to keep it. And that when it's obvious that it's just too much of an impediment, and it's not going to help you anymore," he said, "then just let it go." And then, so she held on and strove to get better, strove to continue to live for a few more years. And Swami remarked she made a lot of spiritual progress during those years. So that's sort of half the question: is my body still helping me? And at what point then is it time to let it go? So, well, that was kind of a hard ending. Is there anything else?
Can I ask you something on dreams?
Okay.
The last, say, a week or so, I have constantly, every few days, been in a dream of my mother-in-law,
uh-huh,
who has passed away many years back.
Right.
And it's quite vivid.
Uh-huh.
Like that day I met him for her, and she took a sip and she said, "It's cold and I can't have it," or something. It's,
uh-huh,
it's quite clear and distinct. So, if you could say something.
something? Do they mean something, or do they just? It's coming quite frequently, so I'm just thinking if there's any.
Swamiji was saying that most dreams are just your subconscious mind reiterating what's happened. If it's a meaningful dream, it has more power, more clarity, and more of a capacity to uplift. Alternatively, as Swamiji said once to me, the body sleeps, the brain sleeps, but superconsciousness never sleeps. So you can be in contact with all kinds of higher levels of reality when your body's asleep because your consciousness is still awake. So perhaps she's in the astral world and she's interested in you. Or perhaps it's just cycling through your subconscious mind and you're remembering. You only have to take it seriously if it really gives you something that you know that you need to deal with. But if it's not obvious, Swamiji has told us, just don't worry about it, just let it pass. It doesn't have to mean anything if it doesn't seem to. Okay? You don't have to worry about it, is what I'm trying to say.
I came once too often.
Yeah.
So I was just like, sometimes some people, we get a dream of someone, but that's once in a while, right. So it doesn't mean something. But if it was repeating quite a few days, so I just.
Maybe somewhere in the cosmos she's thinking of you. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Well, that's,
yeah. She's missing it, let's say that. Everybody has an answer, and I think they're all good answers. Yeah. Yeah. When they really visit you, you know it. My mother visited me 3 times after she died, and I really knew it. She appears in my dreams every once in a while, but she's not really visiting me. When she has really visited me, which she did 3 times, I knew it for a certainty. And the meaning was self-evident. You know, other times, you know, maybe she was dropping in, but there was no real meaning in it, you know. Yeah. All right, great souls. I think we may have refreshments or something. Is that true? Okay. Thank you all. I thank you very much for sharing this evening. It's really been a joy to be with you.
Thank you so much.